Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. Now we're going to take a listen to an interview we previously recorded with nuclear expert Stephen Starr about nuclear arms and what would happen to the world if these weapons were ever used, as only the United States has actually done in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We think it's important context for the debate going on now around Korea and the Singapore summit.
The United States is in the midst of a $1 trillion upgrade of its nuclear weapons arsenal, and there appears to be little progress being made toward a nuclear-free world. These weapons of mass destruction have become normalized in the minds of so many Americans, but what would it really look like if a nuclear exchange were to actually happen? We're joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr, a professor at the University of Missouri who teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. Stephen is also a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility and has a number of articles on nuclear weapons published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the Federation of American Scientists. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
Stephen, so many politicians, especially on the right wing of the American political spectrum, say and apparently believe that a nuclear war is actually winnable. What would a nuclear war look like?
Well, in order to understand what a nuclear war would be like, I think it's important to, you have to start out with, let's just say, a single large strategic nuclear weapon being exploded over a city. The article that I wrote for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was about what an 800 kiloton nuclear warhead would do to Manhattan. 800 kilotons, that means 800,000 tons of TNT explosive equivalent. However, TNT is not a really great analogy because better to think of a nuclear weapon like a small piece of the sun that's brought to the earth. When it detonates, it creates a fireball. The center of it's about 200 million degrees Fahrenheit. And within 1 second, it'll create a fireball about a mile in diameter. And the surface of the fireball is actually 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the surface of the sun. So this just starts immense fires over a large surface area. It would create, under all weather conditions, about 90 square miles of a fire zone that would be instantly ignited. And then typically it'd be more like 150 square miles. And anything that's in the fire zone is not going to survive.
We're looking at your article in the Bulletin. This is the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It's co-authored, I think, with you, Lynn Eden, and Theodore Postol. And it's published February 25th, 2015. For our audience, if you want to find the article, the title is, What Would Happen If an 800-kiloton nuclear warhead detonated above Midtown Manhattan? I want to read the first paragraph because I think it's very sort of sets the stage for people to understand what's going on. Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles are believed to carry a total of approximately 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads that can hit the U.S. less than 30 minutes after being launched. Of this total, about 700 warheads are rated at 800 kilotons. That is, each has the explosive power of 800,000 tons of TNT. What follows is a description of the consequences of the detonation of just a single such warhead over Midtown Manhattan. It's an amazing description, and you have graphics that also help the lay audience, meaning all of us, the public, sort of visualize or understand what this would mean. You start your article, Stephen, about the Russian capability. What is the American capability about the same? And is there symmetry here? Is there some sort of parity?
Yes, there is. The United States also has about 1,000, we call them launch-ready nuclear weapons, just as the Russian weapons. They typically, the land-based weapons can be launched in two or three minutes. But it's within 15 minutes for all these warheads. And U.S. warheads, the large warheads on the Trident subs are about 455 kilotons. So the fire zones may be a little bit smaller. But, you know, when you're talking about in a nuclear war, if you have thousands of warheads going off within an hour, that basically you would have tens of thousands of square miles of the surface of the earth on fire. And primarily it would be a lot of urban areas because, you know, there's only a total of about 500 cities in the U.S. and Russia that have populations of greater than 100,000 people. And so, and most of those are going to either be include military targets or be adjacent to them. And so So it's a total nightmare scenario. But there's symmetry in that.
And are all the major cities, say in the United States or in Russia, are they all targeted?
You know, targeting information is always that's like a top secret. And if you approach the military about this, they're going to tend to say, oh, no. You know, back in the Clinton years, they had this kind of a political thing where they had a zero targeting where the weapons were supposed to be not targeted on cities anymore. But the reality is it takes 10 seconds or less to convey target information to a warhead. So in any military, you know, confrontation where weapons like this would be launched, it'd immediately be retargeted. So, yeah, there's a guy named Hans Christensen who's a real expert, has written about, they used to be called a single integrated operational plan. Now it's called CON plan, but these are the war plans that the U.S. have. And I'm sure that the Russian plans are analogous. The top targeting priorities include, you know, nuclear and conventional forces, but also the top military and political leadership, the military industrial targets. And those are a lot of those in urban and communication centers. So, you know, again, if we have a couple thousand warheads going off, you know, what are the odds that 200 or 300 cities would be hit?
I have to ask you, too, about fallout. You know, we talk so much about cities or installations that are specifically targeted, but then that nuclear cloud has to go somewhere. And in the event of the use of multiple nuclear weapons, what about the chances of a nuclear winter? What about the chances of the sun being blocked out and this nuclear cloud moving over greater populations?
Right. Well, I referred to some peer-reviewed studies that they were produced at the UCLA, University of Colorado, Boulder, and Rutgers around 2007. And these were updated nuclear winter studies from the original ones that were in the 1980s. And they used state-of-the-art computer models, and they're the same computer modeling that's used to predict weather. But these guys, these are the top climatologists in the world, and they what they did was they estimated the environmental impact of nuclear war. And this is the primary impact they found in their climatological approach was what the smoke would do. The smoke, of course, is going to be radioactive, as you imply, and that's got a whole other series of implications. But, you know, the one warhead that we talked about initially, the 800 kiloton warhead, there's, say 150 square miles on fire. If you have a couple thousand of those, the scientists estimated that somewhere between 50 to 180 million tons of soot and smoke would rise up quickly above cloud level because it kind of it's heated by the sun too. And once it gets into the stratosphere, it takes about 10 days for it to circle the Earth. And then in a relatively short period of time, it would form a very dense global stratospheric smoke layer because it can't be rained out by the clouds. It will remain there for a decade or longer. And so that has a massive impact. A large nuclear war, they predict, would block up to 70% of the sunlight in the northern hemisphere and 35% in the southern. So this would make it at noon, it would almost be looking like the sun at midnight. It would create below freezing temperatures every day in the central U.S. and central Eurasia for 1 to 3 years. It would completely eliminate growing seasons for quite a few years, maybe as many as 10 years. So what that means is people, you know, most people and animals would starve to death. So I've talked about that a lot because you don't even have to talk about radioactive fallout if the nuclear winter is going to eliminate agriculture.
Yeah, the smoke, the radioactive smoke will do it. We've had a Hans Christensen, who you mentioned, who's an expert also on nuclear weapons, and Daniel Ellsberg, our friend, on this show where we've talked about the impact of smoke and the impact of the radioactivity, not to mention the fire and the initial impact. I mean, it's almost beyond sort of comprehension in a way. We want to talk about it, though, because we should be comprehending it, because this is the weapon systems that we are paying for. These are the weapon systems that are being modernized, not eliminated right now. We're joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr. Stephen is a professor at the University of Missouri. He teaches at the Peace Studies Program on the environmental health and social effects of nuclear weapons. And he's published many, many articles, including for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Stephen, when we think about it, again, not comprehensible in a way beyond our imagination, how did we get to this point? I mean, it all started with one nuclear and then a second nuclear bomb on the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945. And then it seems that this arms race where all countries that want to, well, not all, but many want to have nuclear weapons. These are weapons that actually can't be used without not just extinguishing the enemy, but extinguishing life. Anyway, it's an amazing sort of terrible legacy, tragedy, and it's had its own powerful life, I guess, the life of this death machine.
Right. I think, you know, what happened after World War II was that the scientists that had produced the weapons were basically begging to prevent a nuclear arms race, but it really wasn't in their hands anymore. And the military tended to look at these weapons. Well, first, we had atomic bombs. You know, the atomic bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki is very, I hate the word small, but it's the explosive power. The strategic weapons that we use, we're talking about now, are at least 7 to 85 times more powerful. And we had a lot larger weapons that were typical back in the 50s. What happened is they invented the hydrogen bomb, the thermonuclear bomb, in the early 1950s. And then we started stockpiling those. And I honestly think that, you know, we had this mindset, you know, you always have to have more bombs than the other side. But somehow they lost track of the fact that like 300 of these weapons would utterly destroy any nation. And so we wound up, you know, by the 1960s, whether we knew it or not, we basically had a self-destruct mechanism for the human race. And this went on to, I think in 1986, there were about 60 to 70,000 nuclear weapons that were operational and deployed, primarily, you know, 95% U.S. and the Soviet Union. You know, then right about that time was when the first nuclear winter studies came out, and they were unusual because these were scientists that were were mostly working for NASA, using the NASA Cray computers that were state-of-the-art computers back then, relatively primitive climate models, but they came out and predicted that you know, a war would cause the nuclear winter that would wipe out most of the human race. And I think that was one of the main motivators for the arms control treaties that followed later on in the early 90s when they were signed. But, you know, we seem to have forgotten that. And it worries me very much. You know, I wrote an article for the Federation of American Scientists called Turning a Blind Eye Towards Armageddon. And it was about the fact that the U.S. leadership has rejected the nuclear winter studies. One of the guys that I work with, Greg Mello, he's on your show, has provided the information that made it clear that the people that are actually making decisions about the weapons and targeting are they said, we don't believe that. So, you know, they've rejected these peer-reviewed studies that are the best science that we can provide that have been out there for 11 years. We're still moving forward with nuclear modernization and nuclear war games. It's like they don't want to acknowledge this. So that's, the scientists are very much distressed about this. It's kind of hard to know what to do. You know, you think if you put a warning out like this, that people would listen.
Yeah. And the weapons we're talking about now, strategic nuclear weapons, 75 to 80 times as strong as Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, Stephen, I wish I didn't have to ask you to do this, but because so many people don't know, I mean, it's not really taught in our schools, and it's not really a subject of public education through the media. What actually happened using this, quote, small atomic bomb to Hiroshima and to Nagasaki?
Well, an atomic bomb like of that type, a 15 kiloton, 15,000 ton TNT explosive equivalent, which are typical of the weapons that a country like India and Pakistan first produces, an emerging nuclear weapon state, you know, that creates a fire zone about 3 to 5 square miles in diameter. And so, but the thing is, these weapons still create these horrendous, like solar-like temperatures. So they'll create a firestorm where within the fire zone, no one's going to survive. If you detonate the bomb to maximize thermal effects of fire, then the fireball will not touch the surface of the earth. That was the case in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But if you're trying to say dig out a crater where there's a military facility and the fireball does touch the earth, then it vaporizes everything. And then enormous amounts of fallout will go up. And we really haven't you know, we saw that with some of the nuclear tests. And by the way, you know, the U.S. had 100 above-ground nuclear tests in Nevada, and the whole North America, Mexico, Canada, but the United States had fallout all over it. And they've kept those masks classified for a long time. But I think it's had profound health effects. I think it was like probably one of the worst environmental disasters that could have happened. But that's a separate story.
Stephen, is there such a thing as a defensive nuclear weapon? Is that possible?
Well, you know, the whole argument with nuclear weapons is deterrence. And they've created a language craft around that to say, well, they don't talk about weapons. They say, well, we need our deterrent. Well, who can be against a deterrent, right? So it's a very clever sort of way to market it. But deterrence is a hypothetical. You know, in order to have nuclear deterrence, you have to have everybody has to be sane to begin with 24/7, because it's premised on the idea that our deterrent will keep you from attacking us. And in other words, it'll create unacceptable retaliation and destruction. But that unacceptable is kind of depends on the mind of the attacker, right? I mean, what if they're not afraid of death, or what if they're crazy? I mean, we have had leaders in not too long distance past that were, I mean, pretty certifiable. And
why talk about the past? Why talk about the past?
So in other words, if you think nuclear deterrence will work perfectly forever, I think that's a lot more naive than think it's possible to eliminate these giant arsenals that threaten the human race.
Stephen Starr is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're spending the entire 30 minutes in this segment talking with Professor Starr about what it would look like to have a nuclear weapons attack, or for there to be a nuclear exchange. Again, going back to your article that was published in 2015, you can find it at thebulletin.org. It's the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. Here's what it says. The initial fireball, the warhead, this we're talking about just one strategic nuclear weapon detonated over Manhattan. The warhead would be detonated slightly more than a mile above the city to maximize the damage created by its blast wave. Within a few tenths of millionths of a second, I mean, we don't even know what that is, after detonation, the center of the warhead would reach a temperature of roughly 200 million degrees Fahrenheit, about 100 million degrees Celsius, or about 4 to 5 times the temperature at the center of the sun. I mean,
can't even comprehend it.
Again, it's beyond comprehension.
Right. And so, you know, if you are 9 miles away from that point of detonation in your direct line of sight, you'll receive first and second degree burns.
How far away?
9 miles.
9 miles away.
Crazy.
So what that means is that anything in that area gets ignited. I mean, anything that's remotely flammable, within 10 to 15 minutes, all these innumerable fires will join together into one gigantic mass fire. The fireball goes up like 300 miles per hour and creates this giant chimney effect. So it creates hurricane force winds that go in towards the center of the fire. And it's strong enough to uproot trees. You know, it'll suck people back into the fire if you're even on the edge of it. And within 10 or 15 minutes, all the air within that fire zone is above the boiling point of water. So it's impossible to survive. That's why my website, I focus primarily on thermal effects with my nuclear firestorm simulator. Because, you know, the blast is what war planners focus on, you know. But if you happen to be a civilian in a fire zone, then that's you're doomed. And those are the prompt effects, you know. I mean, I've worked at the UN for a number of years trying to, I was the first person, I think, to take these studies, the new studies on nuclear winter, in 2007 and present them at the UN. And, you know, there's 122 nations that have signed on the treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons. There wasn't so much interest, but, when these countries, particularly, say, those in the Southern Hemisphere, figured out that their populations are likely to starve to death from nuclear winter, then they get a lot more interested in preventing a nuclear war.
The United States is demanding that North Korea give up its nuclear weapons. And North Korea says right now that they favor denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. I'm looking at some of the interviews, like including from James Clapper, the ex-director of National Intelligence.
Well, the guy that lied to Congress, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, the statute of limitations for that expires.
What was his exact? I think he didn't admit to lying. I think he said it was the least untrue thing
right.
he could say.
Yeah. But the answer was yes, and he said no.
Yeah. It was the least untruth. No. The answer was yes. But he's making the argument now that the North Koreans are actually trying to trick Donald Trump by demanding that all of the nuclear weapons in or around Korea, including U.S. nuclear weapons, sort of be taken out of the area, and that the U.S. not provide South Korea with a nuclear umbrella. And so he's saying, well, the North Koreans are trying to trick us because we, the Americans, insist really. I mean, that's what he's saying. What he's really saying is that we insist that the Korean Peninsula not be denuclearized. We just want North Korea to be denuclearized
right.
so that we can have a sole monopoly on nuclear weapons. I mean, why would North Korea, Stephen, go along with that?
I think that people also lose sight of the fact that, you know, we can hit any point on the globe with a nuclear weapon within 30 minutes. And we have Triton subs that also carry nuclear armed cruise missiles. So if there's forward-facing nuclear weapons, sometimes seems to me to be more of a political statement than military, because I mean, it's very dangerous, I think, because the more you disperse nuclear weapons and make them available to lower levels of command, the more likely they are to be used if any sort of, or even stolen, you know, but you can forget about that. But I think the real crux of the matter is that does North Korea want to get rid of their, do they trust the U.S. enough to get rid of their nuclear arsenal?
Yeah. Here's what he said. Here's what Clapper said on national TV yesterday. I think they should just about, it's unclear, listening to what the North Koreans might say when asked what it is that would take you to feel secure so you don't need nuclear weapons. And one more point we ought to think about. When we say denuclearization of the nuclear, denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, this could have been a two-way street, and the North Koreans could start to assert that we have a responsibility to denuclearize and restrict our nuclear umbrella, meaning no B-1s, B-2s, or B-52s flying into the Korean Peninsula, landing in the Korean Peninsula, or in operational proximity. So it seems to me that those are the things they ought to discuss. Clapper, though, is afraid of that. So yes, I hear you about forward placement of weapons may be unnecessary, maybe mainly a political statement, but certainly for the people in Korea who endured 3 years of U.S. bombing from 50 to 53, to have B-1s or B-2s or B-52s, all of which are advanced nuclear, you know, platforms flying around them, it keeps them in a state of constant tension, constant alert.
Well, you know, it gets back to the fact that the Korean War never really ended. And that's why I think it's better that the North and South Koreans are talking about trying to normalize relations. I see that as the most important political development that's going on. I mean, the U.S., in the Korean War, the U.S. literally destroyed every building in North Korea. You know, about 30% of the North Korean population was killed. And these were primarily from like 38,000 tons of napalm that we dropped on there. It's another thing that you really don't learn about in our schools. But, you know, the Koreans have a very vivid memory of that, just like the Russians have a very vivid memory of losing 28 million people in World War II. So it's going to be pretty hard to convince them that they should trust the U.S. And the problem with people like Clapper is that they don't believe in any sort of disarmament in the first place. And like you said, you know, the nuclear weapons are always okay if there are weapons. Every country looks at it like that.
They're democratic. They're the weapons of the free world.
Yeah, every country views their own nuclear arsenal as important and safe. It's just the other countries' arsenals that are dangerous. But so then you wind up right now when we have a total of, you know, something like, I don't know, at least 14,000 intact nuclear weapons. And the scientific studies show that, you know, just the detonation of a couple thousand of those is going to be enough to wipe out the human race. You know, what do we do? I mean, I personally think it's a lot smarter to acknowledge this. You know, President Putin has been probably the one leader who's come closest in recent memory to publicly warning about the danger of nuclear war, I mean, the existential threat, but he hasn't elaborated on it. And I think that Russia and the, you know, Russian people in the U.S., all people would be well served if some leader would come forward and publicly discuss these scientific predictions about nuclear winter and even allow the scientists to speak. because people don't know about this. I really, you know, it's part of the reason I teach a class at the University of Missouri. The students that come in are very smart, but they don't know the difference between an atomic bomb and a hydrogen bomb. In about three weeks, they're horrified by what they've learned. And even the most gung-ho guys will right off the bat say, well, no, we should never have a nuclear war. And that should be the starting point of all discussions on nuclear weapons, is the existential threat they pose to the human race.
You know, when I was in college, a film ran on television called The Day After. You might remember this. And it was so graphic and so impactful. It showed what would happen the day after a nuclear attack on the United States. And
yeah, that was actually Kansas City in Missouri. Where
yeah, that's right. It was Kansas City or Lawrence, Kansas, something like that. And
yeah.
it was clear that it's just simply not winnable. And even though it was fictionalized, of course, the conclusion has to be the same everywhere. It's just simply not winnable. It kills everybody, civilians and military alike. And there's just no way for humanity to get past something like that.
Stephen Starr, how much are we spending on nuclear weapons, by the way, or have we spent?
Well, a guy named Stephen Schwartz has done a lot of work on that. He used to be one of the editors at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and he calculated something like $7 trillion in the U.S., and that was a few years ago. You know, I've been upset because under Obama, they basically made a deal where they're going to rebuild the entire nuclear weapons manufacturing infrastructure in the U.S., and that's even in Kansas City, Missouri, again, they have a plant where they produce like 80% of the non-nuclear components for nuclear weapons. It was one of the largest building projects in the state for a while, and I kept thinking, you know, can't we do better than this? Wouldn't it be better if we were like building like a square mile of solar collectors or something like that, or wind farms instead of bombs? But, you know, we get back to a general ignorance. As long as you can wave the flag and say, well, these are for our defense and it's patriotic, and if we didn't have these weapons, the country wouldn't exist. These are kind of the arguments they always fall back on. But I just think that it's time to recognize that these weapons also, if they're used, will eliminate the United States along with just about every other country on the planet.
Stephen, we have 1 minute left. I mean, what's the scenario in which they would be used? All the contingency planners know this is the extinction of humanity, or maybe they don't, but they might. What's the scenario? How could it happen?
Well, what I worry about is sort of an incremental. I mean, the problem is if the U.S. and Russia get into a direct military conflict, or even the U.S. and North Korea and nuclear weapons are used, then it opens up this Pandora's box. Both sides in the U.S. and Russia are tasked with destroying the other side's nuclear forces in the event of war. And once any military conflict would break out, whether it be in Ukraine or Syria or someplace like that, and shooting starts, we move up to a whole different level, you know, DEFCON 2. I mean, we're at the point where they're ready to push the button. And so then any false warning of attack, I mean, we've had a lot of those in the past, could trigger a retaliatory strike for a non-existent first strike. You know, we could launch the weapons believing that Russia had launched at us and we're wrong. But I don't necessarily see a deliberate attack out of bolt out of the blue. But I think that if we were stupid enough to get into a military conflict,
yeah, we're going to pay the price. We're going to pay a very steep price.
It's going to ratchet up. It doesn't take very long. Everything, the electronic connections and the computers and everything are so fast that all these signals. Cuban Missile Crisis, we had liquid-fueled rockets that took, you know, 24 hours to fuel up. And now it's just 15 seconds that can the president give the launch order.
Living or almost dying on the edge.
And we're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr, a professor at the University of Missouri. He teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. And Stephen's also a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility and has a number of articles on nuclear weapons published by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and the Federation of American Scientists. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.